All right. Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Aaron. I'm the deacon at Christ Church, the oldest Protestant church in the Middle East. Has anybody heard of it?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. All right. Well, our topic tonight is the dreaded word that is so often not wanted to be said in this country, the word mission or missionary. And too often the word gives, you know, negative connotations of negative emotions, different negative reactions in people. You say that you're a missionary and immediately people think of soul stealing, they think of, you know, family destroying, they think of those crazy tract waving people who walk around the street, or just outright strange people. But too often is ignored the impact of Protestant mission, the positive impact I'm going to advocate tonight of Protestant mission in the process of sociological, economical, demographical, and political modernization of the Middle East and practically the world over. But our topic is going to be focusing on the Middle East. Has the Protestant mission actually been positive? I'm going to argue yes. Particularly all the positives that come from being here in Jerusalem. Now, much ignorance exists in the discussion around the positive influences that Protestant missionary movements have had on the Middle East and indeed at the world at large. As the Protestant mission is usually divest of any sort of state sanction and funding, the political influence that the Protestant mission has on developing countries is so overlooked. Many focus solely on the numerical effectiveness to gauge how positive a missionary movement has been. Basically, people want to know, how many converts have you got? How many people did you baptize on the weekend? But the effect of Protestant mission, particularly in this country, is not in its numerical value. The value is somewhere else. Its impact, as I'm going to mention tonight, is going to be on medicine, education, the judiciary, sociological improvements. Primarily, why is this? Primarily, this is due to the secular problem in understanding human motivation. Why a secular world and secular researchers and people who look at the effect of Protestant missions don't understand missionaries. Why do we do what we do? St. Paul describes that what we cherish is foolishness to the Greeks. And so the secular world in their journals don't understand the motivation behind the mission and what it did. In a recent study by Woodbury, and I'm going to cite here Hal Varoning, who gave me an excellent article, coming from the University of Singapore. This is a very detailed study. And it was published in the American Political Science Review, volume 106, in 2012. He demonstrated in great detail how Protestant mission the world over was a catalyst for religious liberty, tolerance, mass education for the lower classes, mass printing, colonial reforms, legal codification, protection of minorities, medical advancements, and improving the social conditions for the general public. How is that for a bit of a mouthful? Basically, these improvements in societies where Protestant missions were set up ultimately led to democracy. Let's have a look, if you will, at this diagram which he produced. Woodbury's studies demonstrate that Protestant settlement versus Catholic settlements had a far higher chance of actually ending in a democracy. So Catholic missionary movements ended up in totalitarian regimes, perhaps in places like Argentina, Chile, Uruguay, Costa Rica. Whereas Protestant missions and Dutch missions in Africa, Canada, Australia, United States, New Zealand ended up in flourishing democracies. Now, how did this work? Let's have a look, if you can, at this diagram at the top. Not the text, okay, the actual diagram. So, what you have is in the center, in bold print, is this thing called the conversionary Protestants. These are the missionaries who are going out to convert people. And Usually, people want to say, well, how many people did you convert? Well, let's have a look at what they did. These guys came as within a colonial environment, but they were not part of the state-sanctioned colonialism. They were not funded by the state. So they were part of the state apparatus, perhaps, but were not funded by the state, so they were often actually critical of the colonial powers that they were in. So they, as Protestants, set up mass education, mass printing, changes in civil society, hospitals and schools. This led to things like economic development. Once you have mass education, you are improving the literacy of poor people. You are literally creating a new class of people, which he would call the middle class. The printing press and mass education produces a public sphere. Now you have people actually communicating ideas to each other. And once you have that happening, you have the potential to lead to a democracy. Right? The colonial powers themselves don't do this. Who is actually doing this? It's the Protestant mission. Now, why are they trying to mass educate everybody? Why are they trying to produce printing presses everywhere?
What?
Yes, you want people to read the Bible. So the actual motivation of the mission is still, I want you to read the Bible. I want you to hear the good news of Jesus as the Messiah. I want you to come to faith. The effect is, might not be mass numbers going down to the Jordan River to be baptized. The effect is, we're actually producing a middle class, we're improving literacy, we're improving the society, we're advocating women's rights and decreasing child labor laws, and we may actually end up with a democracy. So that's what that little diagram there. It's a well-argued piece of literature.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
The four things on the left-hand side of the diagram, are these the situations that the missionaries... Protestant missionaries respond to?
Yes. So what he does is, in the rest of the article, there are a series of charts. And what he would have how difficult was it for the mission to go to this area. And so if it was very difficult, then perhaps the chance of it becoming a democracy may not have succeeded, because perhaps the printing press couldn't produce the texts to get to the people. These kinds of variables. Muslim rulers. Why did the Middle East not create and spawn democracies? Okay, whereas places like Africa, parts of Latin America, parts of Asia did. Those are the sort of factors. He calls them like factor 1, 2, 3, 4 in other parts of the study. But what I wanted to show from here is the arrows that the Protestants are doing. The missionaries are producing economic development. In this country, it'll be called the House of Industry. We'll get to that in a minute. Mass education. Here, it's going to be with the Protestant introduction of the school system. Mass printing, producing literature for people. Changes in civil society, where the Protestants actually challenge the colonial powers of its day. And will say things like, you actually can't have slaves. Okay, what you're doing is not right. You actually have to pay these people a livable wage. These kinds of, and advocating for social rights, things like that. So, I have a question, because this is the Middle East, and we always love to ask questions. What motivates the Protestant mission? Okay, what is it that motivates us?
It's the enlargement of the kingdom of God.
Enlargement of the kingdom of God. Where do we get that concept from?
Friend Jesus.
Yes. The Bible. Right? It was the Bible is the thing that empowers and promotes and drives the Protestant mission. It's the Bible and how you read it. So I would argue that how you read your Bible changes your behavior. Okay? Thus, the story of the Protestant arrival into the Middle East begins with the printing press. So why are Protestants so interested in the Middle East? We've had the Middle East for thousands of years. Protestants show up, but they don't arrive here for nearly 300 years. What was it that drove them here? Prior to the printing press, how did people read their Bible?
It was
read to them.
It was read to them. Okay, so people would arrive, and then someone who knew how to read, who actually had access to a Bible, would read. A lot of us were illiterate. We didn't know how to read. So if we didn't have anybody who was around to read us the sacred texts, to hear the wonderful stories of Jesus as the Messiah, how would we hear the gospel? Stained glass windows.
Yeah. That's true.
Our Bible was visual. It was a visual gospel. We would go to these beautiful cathedrals and beautiful churches, and we would look at the stained glass window, and we would see a man holding onto a sheep. And we would go, son, that's Jesus, the good shepherd. Or we'll have a look at a man with his hand out like this, holding back the waves. And we'll say, okay, son, that's Jesus calming the storm. Look how powerful he is. So we would read the gospel through our eyes. And what happened with the printing press is it actually produced a piece of material that we could hold. We didn't have to go to churches now and read them. We didn't have to have people read them to us in languages that we couldn't understand anyway. Okay, we could actually read the text for ourselves. Now, even though printed material had been around in Asia 800 years prior to our friend Gutenberg, okay, the Chinese printing presses were only for the elites of society. They weren't for the masses. And that's the difference. The difference between Catholic, Protestant, and the pre-Asian uses of the printing press are different. In China, it was for the elites. In Catholic areas of Europe, they had a less proportion of printed material per capita than Protestants. Protestants basically went mad. Now we've got a printing press, we just go nuts. We produce all kinds of stuff, and we get as much as we can out there. And that's what changes a society. So, the first book off the Bible for Mr. Gutenberg is what? Sorry, the printing press? I just gave it away. The Bible. Okay. Lots of other printed material shows up as well. Okay. This is going to be a generalization. And it is a generalization, and I admit it. Protestants had a tendency to take the Bible literally, as opposed to some of the other traditions, which had a tendency to take the text more allegorically or spiritually. So now that we actually have this text, this is several hundred years ago, Protestants begin to read it, and they would actually begin to look at this Bible and take it literally, except that there's one book that no one takes literally. Which one is it?
Song of Songs.
Song of Songs. Yes. It's the same book that the Jewish people read allegorically. Right? Okay, because basically if we took the Song of Songs literally, we would all be wondering what an erotic love poem was doing in our Bible. Okay? Because you might want to know what, when Shulamit gets her hands on Solomon, all kinds of crazy things are going to happen. What is that doing in my Bible? And so it becomes an allegorical story of God loving and in search of man. And the Jewish commentaries are the same. In fact, we probably borrowed from them. So in the 18th century, this is the 1700s, people would be reading the Bible and they discovered many things in this sacred text. Morality, things that God liked, things that God didn't like, piety, holiness, the fact that the Messiah was not coming back to Paris. Prior to the return of the Messiah, several events had to occur based on a literal reading of the Bible. What do you think they are?
Gospel going to the whole world?
Yes. The gospel had to be preached to all the nations. It was one of the commands of Jesus in Matthew 28. But from a stained glass window, that wasn't quite one of the things you got. But when you actually had the text, you actually had the Messiah giving an instruction. You will take this gospel where? To Judea, from Jerusalem to Judea, to the ends of the earth. So the Protestant movement began to look at that and say, you know what? We haven't done that. And so there was this explosion of missionary activity late in the 1700s and early into the 1800s. Now, how long had Protestants been around for? When was the... Yes. So for nearly 300 years, what were Protestants doing in terms of world mission? Zippo, right? Absolutely nothing. As we were discussing before, prior to this lecture, who was taking the gospel to the nations?
Catholics.
Yes. There's these guys. Okay. Next lecture by Dr. David Mark Neuhaus of the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits. Okay, they had an organized, active world mission program. They are the guys who went to places and built hospitals and schools. They dug wells for communities. And they shared the gospel in their fashion. And you have to give them a salute. A lot of their missionaries died. A lot of their missionaries went there believing that they were doing God's will, and they are. And they succumbed, and more followed. And they did a great job. Us, we were too busy with our own internal problems over here in Europe. Okay?
But Herrnhut was like 200-something years after the Reformation.
Who was?
Herrnhut. And the first Protestant missions going out of
Herrnhut was... It was late. So I'll give you a list of some of the names of the mission societies and their start dates, which is all available on that wonderful device known as the internet, where you all get all of the best of theology, yes? Yes. So at the turn of the 1698, we have the Society for Promoting Christian Knowledge. There's a good one. Has this one, 1701. Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts. We have the here comes this explosion, 1792, Baptist Mission Society, but its real name was the Particular Baptist Society for the Promotion of the Gospel Amongst the Heathen. I love these archaic names. Okay, the Bible Society, established in 1779. Right, we've actually had the Bible since the late 1400s. But finally, 300 years later, let's get a Bible society together for soldiers and seamen. Later on, in 1804, it actually becomes the British and Foreign Bible Society. London Missionary Society, 1795. Church Missionary Society, 1799. You noticing all these dates? Very close together. Scottish Mission Society, 1796. Religious Tract Society, got a printing press, may as well use it, 1799. 1813, the Wesleyan Missionary Society. 1817, General Baptist Missionary Society, because there's lots of different Baptists out there. Colonial and Continental Society, 1823. There's between late 1790 and the early 1830s, there's a missionary explosion. There's a few societies before, there's a dearth of afterwards, but it's in this 30 to 40 year window that you find the Protestant world getting motivated. What was it that was motivating us?
The Wesleyan Revival.
The Bible, yeah. Okay, it was the...
But the Wesleyan Revival, again, happened because of Herrnhut. So please don't miss that.
Sure.
So it's 1732.
Right.
Started at 1732.
Right. But it's like in 1732, you have the Wesleyan Revival. It's a large movement, but it's one. It's not this giant wave of all at the same time. I'm not denying that didn't happen. What I'm advocating is within this time period between the 1790s and the 1830s, there's a wave of Protestant missionary explosion. Right? There's ones that come after, and there's a few that come before. But it's not like the world is having a Protestant missionary explosion, but that occurs towards the end of the 1700s. And it's into this world that we see a gentleman by the name of Joseph Samuel Levi, Josef Shmuel Levi, who is from Francovia in Germany. He becomes a believer in 1795 because he was trapped on a carriage with a gentleman who was named Christian, who shared the gospel through Jeremiah 31. And when Joseph Samuel Levi became a believer, as was the custom back then, he changed his name to Christian, and Christian Frey. But we'll call him Joseph Samuel Levi. And fueled with passion for this gospel that he had now received, he trained to be a mission in the London Mission Society in 1801. However, he was a better Yiddish-speaking man than he was English, and English speaking, even though he was being trained to go to Africa, to Swaziland. And he actually spent a lot of time working with Yiddish-speaking people in East London. And he thought, listen, why should I be being trained to go to deepest, darkest Africa when I'm being used by my own people whom I speak and I can connect with here? So the London Mission Society said, yes, good idea, you stay here. However, as he began to work amongst the London Mission, he discovered that the London Missionary Society didn't have the resources to adequately cope with a Jewish mission or anything actually occurring in London. All their resources were being directed overseas. So, what's a good little Jewish boy to do if you don't have a missionary society that can assist you? Start your own. And he did. Obviously not alone. He was joined by a large number of people who were members of a thing called the Clapham Group or the Clapham Sect, Clapham Club, whatever name it wants to go by. So some of those notable names are William Wilberforce. You heard of him? Everyone saw the movie Amazing Grace? Yes? Didn't talk about the London Jewish Society at all in that movie. Okay, talked a lot about him. At the same time as Mr. Wilberforce is passionate about getting rid of slavery, he is just as passionate about the gospel going to the Jewish people. So William Wilberforce, Barclay, Lewis Way, Charles Simeon, these guys formed a society known as the London Society for Promoting Christianity Amongst the Jews. Back then, you had to have a long name in your mission society, otherwise it didn't sound well, and it was shortened to the London Jews Society, and today it's known as CMJ, Church's Ministry Among Jewish People, but it is still the same society. It was a joint mission, an independent mission, a London society. It was a joint mission with the Prussian Lutheran Church, headed up by Frederick Wilhelm IV, the Church of Scotland, the Presbyterians, and the Church of England, the Anglicans. So you had Lutherans, Anglicans, and Presbyterians joining together to have a mission society for Jewish people. What makes the world philo-Semitic in 1809? The Bible. You have produced the printing press. The printing press produces the Bible. Protestants are mad keen that you read this text, that you come to know Jesus as the Messiah. What's going to be the fallout of reading this Bible based on a Protestant tradition of reading the text, which back then tended towards literalness? It's different today. Have you noticed? Yeah, if the way you read your Bible changes your behavior. And 200 years ago, Europe, it had all kinds of issues. One of the first societies that William Wilberforce and the Clapham Group produced together, what did they call it? They called it the Society for the Suppression of Vice. Okay, because there was a large amount of vice running around England. And so they were saying, listen, look at what our text says. We actually can't behave like this. So God doesn't actually like this type of behavior. So they produced societies that would run around and show people, yes, via tracts, via preaching, by powerful arguments based upon their motivation that they got from the Bible. And they changed society. And so for a brief moment in time, I mean like 30 years, you end up with this philo-Semitism coming out of Europe. Not everywhere. There was still lots of anti-Semitism, no doubt. But there now, for a little bit of time, was a wave of philo-Semitism. Lots of other missionary groups went all over the world, and that study is excellently covered by in Woodbury's article. But the bit that I'm going to talk about hails from that movement in 1809 as the Protestants then gravitated towards the Middle East. So the London Jews Society included people like the King of Prussia, the Earl of Shaftesbury, the Duke of Kent, Duke of Leeds, 25 of the 26 members of the House of Bishops in London, the Guinness family and the Barclay family. Now, what are dukes and earls and barons and kings doing as members of a missionary society? They read the same Bible. Just because you were a duke or a baron or an earl doesn't mean you were unaffected by this text. For a long time, you didn't have it. A priest would have to tell you what it was in a foreign language, but now you could have it. And so on a Sunday, it would not be uncommon for us to have gone to church and a big carriage would roll up outside, and then the local lord would come to church and sit in the front, just like everybody else. Might put a bit more money in the offering plate, but he was just like everybody else. They were there. And so these guys used their influence and their resources to fund this mission society. So, the Middle East. The Middle East, the process of opening up the Middle East to the world begins in 1798 with the expedition of Napoleon Bonaparte here to the region in his war against Great Britain. Isn't it great to see that the French and British finally getting on? But in 1798, Napoleon had a war at the Battle of the Pyramids. He invaded Egypt because what was his destination? Where did he want to get to? India. Yes. Now, European attention was turned towards the Middle East. Prior to that, it was the Far East was occupying European attention. The East Indies, the places where the money was, the resources. And this is even prior to the scramble for Africa, which occurs in the 1800s. So, for a brief moment in time, at the same time as we're fueled with the Bible, we've now got this action occurring in the Middle East. And the Ottoman Empire, which had been suffering internal tension for quite some time now, okay, it had stopped its expansion into Europe, was actually on retreat. The Ottomans ended up getting as close to the gates of Vienna. So they owned quite a fair bit of Europe, right? But they had now a succession of losses. They had lost territory. They were known as the sick man of Europe. So the church had actually been in the Middle East for 1,800 years, right? So it's not like Protestants arrived and went, wow, good, there's nobody here who's a Christian. Believers had already been here in the forms of the Byzantine, Greek, and Latin churches. And so it is with this geopolitical backdrop that the Protestant missionaries come and they scout the land for a suitable base of operations. In 1819, the Church Missionary Society scouts out Lebanon and Egypt, but they can't actually maintain a base and they retreat. In 1822, the London Jew Society, or CMJ, sends a Jewish believer by the name of Joseph Wolff. He comes to Jerusalem and he sends back a very positive report. He says, "The doors are wide open for us to establish a mission in Palestine. The conditions of the community are incredibly poor. We've got to send doctors here immediately." So they do. And in 1824, an Irish doctor by the name of George Dalton. Joseph Wolff, by the way, was German. Notice that there's a London Missionary Society with no British people in it. Okay, they always used a lot of foreigners. George Dalton, an Irish doctor, comes here in 1824 and attempts to establish a medical institution, basically the invention of the modern medical mission. That is, I will establish a hospital, and I will give free medical care, and when you come and receive my free medical care, I'll tell you the gospel. However, he succumbed to the very illnesses that he was attempting to combat, because Palestine and this region were infected with the plague. And he did not last long. In fact, he died the very next year. Reverend William Lewis appears also on the scene, roughly at the same time, but it ends in failure. So in the 1820s, the missionary movement, the initial push, meets with failure all over the Middle East, and they retreat to their consulates in Beirut and in Constantinople. John Nicolaisen, a Danish Lutheran pastor, appears in 1825, just in time to bury Dalton, and he's at a loss because all of these missionaries, the Protestants, are all suffering from the same thing we all suffer when we come and visit Israel. What's that? No visa. These were Muslim lands, and in Muslim lands they ruled their empire according to the millet system. This was ruled by the Ottoman Turkish Empire, and the Ottoman Turk. Now, Turks are not Arabs. Where do the Turks originally hail from? Anyone know?
Mongolia.
Yeah, they're Mongolian southern. They're Seljuks. They're southern Mongolian, northern Chinese, right? That sort of northern area of China is actually Muslim today. They're not like Chinese, they're Mongolian tribes. And they had been Muslims, and they were brought over to defeat the Crusaders. And they're not Arabs. They ended up wiping out the Byzantium, and the Byzantine Empire ceased to exist. And then they pretty much took over the Arab world as well. And they were the last Muslim nation, apart from Islamic State, to actually have a caliph. The last caliph of the House of Islam was a Turk. And they ruled their vast empire. Lots of people, Arabs, Egyptians, Armenians, Europeans, okay, Persians, by what they called the millet system. And ended up becoming part of the status quo. You had to be part of a recognized community in their empire to engage in economic activity, to purchase property, to build buildings, to engage in negotiations. So it was Muslims on top. Then we had the Greeks, then we had Catholics, then we had Armenians, then we had, you know, various other different Orthodox traditions, Coptic, Ethiopian, and down the bottom were Jews. And who's not on the list? Protestants. So when the Protestant missionaries arrived and said, we would like to purchase property, we would like to have permission to stay, the answer was no. And so the mission had to retreat. So the mission then turned to one prayer and used its assets in the House of Lords. Shaftesbury, who happened to be related by marriage to the Earl of Lord Palmerston, the British Foreign Secretary, and established a vice consul in Jerusalem. Why would the House of Lords want to establish a consulate in Jerusalem? The House of Lords is a secular institution. Jerusalem is not a capital city. It is not an international port town. In the 1800s, it has 14,000 people, and the only thing it exports to the world is soap. It is the plague is here. No other nation has any form of political representation in Jerusalem. Okay, the political center was Ramla. Okay, which is near. Ramla still exists today. So. It was there. That was the Turkish administrative capital. But the consulates were in Beirut and they were in Cairo. But the House of Lords was staffed by people who believed in the Bible. And it was at that window of opportunity that they said, listen, it is in Her Majesty's best interest that we establish a consulate in Jerusalem. Why? Keep an eye on the French. That was one of the reasons. We got to guard the Suez Canal. We are nowhere near the Suez Canal. So Jerusalem gets a vice consulate, the vice consulate was a guy by the name of William Tanner Young, and he appears in Jerusalem in 1833, and establishes the first political presence in Jerusalem for nearly 1,000 years. What's the reaction? If those nasty British have just built a consulate in Jerusalem, what will the French do? They do the same. So the French build a consulate here. Why? Because, you know, the Battle of Waterloo was in 1815. These empires are clashing all over the world. People thought that in the 1800s that was the end of days, right? Wars, and rumors of wars. We're fighting them in the Indies. We're fighting them in Canada. We're fighting them in Africa. We're fighting them everywhere. And so the French came to keep an eye on the British, because you would use your consular mission as part of your spy network. You would be able to keep an eye on everybody. Now, if the French come, the Austro-Hungarians build a consulate here because Napoleon invaded Austria-Hungary on his way to Russia. So the Russians come and the Prussians come. And if the Russians are here, who else comes? America. Isolationist America built a consulate here in 1856. So all of a sudden, within a short window of time, 15 years, Jerusalem is full of consulates. It's on the political map. And who motivated that? Who caused that? Protestants. Because they were motivated by the Bible. They knew that Jerusalem was important because Jesus wasn't coming back to Paris. He was going to come back to Jerusalem. It became a center point for the missionary work and the subsequent results thereof. Okay.
I have a question.
Yes.
How did Nicolaisen manage to buy the property?
Very good question. Okay, so, as I said, he's not allowed to purchase property. So, the opportunity to purchase the land, okay, Nicolaisen convinces the Earl of Shaftesbury, who was obviously very favorable, to ask Lord Palmerston, who was the foreign secretary, to request from the British consulate in Alexandria to request the Pasha of Egypt, who happened to be a guy by the name of Muhammad Ali. You heard of Muhammad Ali? Yes? Yeah, he was actually not Egyptian, but he happened to rule Egypt. And he had been engaged in a rather lengthy and protracted war with the Ottoman Empire. And he had seized Egypt, he had captured Palestine, large sections of Syria, and it looked like he was going to knock off the Ottoman Empire. And, you know, anybody who's played the game Risk, yes, knows that if I'm red and I'm attacking blue, what do I have to do with green? Got to be a friend. What do you want? Stay out of my business. And so this was the opportunity. It's that segment of time. It couldn't have happened before, and it may not have been able to happen later. But within the Egyptian rule, okay, the Protestants gained the permission to purchase property. What they did is they purchased it via an Armenian. So the Armenian owned the land, but then a year later, he gave all the title deeds over to the British consulate, who then immediately gave it to Nicolaisen, right? And so that's how the society purchased its property. So now we own land. We would like to build a church. Except, so if a consulate owns property, what's the land around a consulate? Who owns that?
The government.
Yeah. So the CMJ, the London Jew Society, explained to the Egyptians, we're going to build a church. But don't worry, we're not going to build it on Islamic territory. We're going to build it on Terra Britannia. And they get a special permission called a firman to do just that. And they begin to construct. They weren't actually allowed to call it a church. That was the Muslims were very clear. So they didn't call it a church, they called it the private chapel of the vice-consul. It just happens to be three times the size of his house and seat 200 people of his closest friends and family. The consulate, when he arrives, okay, William Tanner Young, and then later a more successful one but known as James Finn, who lasted a little longer, the mandate of the consulate was to protect British citizens, protect all Protestants, and protect Jews. So Jewish people were afforded political protection for the first time. John Nicolaisen then turned around and held the first Hebrew service in the chapel in 1838. Consul James Finn also bought a property called Kerem Avraham and established an industrial plantation for the employment of Jews in Jerusalem. And so the organization began the expansion of outside the walls. So we've got ourselves a church in good Anglican fashion. Who is the leader of churches? Bishops. And who would be the best bishop for a Jewish mission organization?
Jewish one.
A Jewish one, yeah. And so they scan the horizon and they discover that there's a man by the name of Michael Solomon Alexander, who had been trained as a rabbi in Posen, and he was in England, but the rabbi of a community where he had discovered people in the grip of Bible fever and become a believer. He had been trained as a priest in King's College in Trinity in Dublin, and he was teaching rabbinics and Hebrew in King's College, Cambridge. He's perfect. And so they take him, and in 1842 in walks the first Jewish leader of a church in Jerusalem since the year 135. That's a big deal. What's the reaction? If those nasty Protestants have just put a bishop in Jerusalem, what do the Catholics do? They put an archbishop. The archbishop had been in Cyprus since the year 1244. The Latins had moved their spiritual leader out with the last defeat of the Crusaders. So they reestablish him here in 1856. Christchurch is the first Protestant building in the first Protestant church in the Middle East. It's built in 1840, or dedicated in 1849, built between 1839 and 1849 using stonemasons from Malta. The local stonemasonry had all moved away, and so there was nobody here in Jerusalem who could build straight lines, which is the reason why when you go to the Old City, it looks old. You walk around those quarters and you will discover different types of bricks. Nothing seems to be the same. When walls had fallen down, they weren't made and repaired very well. They just picked up whatever they had access to and used it. Jewish quarter looks different, but that's because it's new. And it's new because the Jordanians blew it up. Right? And so the reason why it's new is because it is new. But when the Protestants came, they wanted to build a proper building. So they brought stonemasons from Malta, established the first modern building in Jerusalem. Those stonemasons didn't all then leave and go back to Malta. They stayed. They actually moved to Bejala, married some of the Arabs, who are quite pretty around here. And the Jerusalem Stone Factory is still in Bethlehem to this day. Okay? And you will find that it is Arabs who are the stonemasons in this country, taught down the line by those guys who came and passed their craft on to the local Arabs. Okay, so now we've got building activity. Now we have these nasty Protestants who have just put a bishop in. The Catholics put an archbishop in. The Greeks upload their beatitude, have a patriarch, and the Russians bring a metropolitan. So all of a sudden, Jerusalem is on the spiritual map. Those nasty Protestants have built a church. What do the Catholics do? They build a bigger one. Then the Greeks need to build a big church to rival the Catholics. And it's a land grab. If the Protestants can own land, we will too. And so everybody begins to purchase property to the point where the Greek Orthodox Church owns 30% of Jerusalem. Okay? A small community took all that property. Even the king of Abyssinia came here in 1871 and built Ethiopian churches. Some of them are actually still standing in the Mare Shearim today.
Quick question. Who was the primary landowner during the 1830s, 40s?
Yes, it would have been Ottoman Turk, but the number of Turks in Jerusalem was actually quite small. So it was Greek, it was the Armenian, it was even Samaritans and purchased owned land. The Jewish people had their quarter, have a guess where? In the Muslim quarter. The Muslim quarter used to be the Jewish quarter. In fact, as you walk around the Muslim quarter, some of you can see the little, what's left of mezuzahs, still on the doors. So it was, there were Turks, and there were Egyptians. And any walk through the Shuk will discover that in the Christian Arab quarter, it's hard to find an Arab. There's a lot of Egyptians and Armenians and Syrians there. All right. So just quickly, the medical mission. Our first doctor died, but let's send another one. And they send a Scot, because, you know, there's just no good English people over there. Edward McGowan comes along, and he establishes a modern hospital in 1844. It had two floors, 12 beds, very close to the church, very close to where the Lutheran guest house is today. And what's the result of his building a little hospital in Jerusalem?
Rothschild.
Yes. So Baron, the Lord Rothschild, Moses Montefiore, the Jewish people are very nervous that a Protestant mission is setting up shop that poor Jewish people are actually attending and hearing the gospel. How would they hear the gospel? Well, as you came and waited in the waiting room to go and see your doctor, there would be a man just standing around reading the Bible. In fact, yes, that's how easy it was. The mission employed three Bible readers. One of them stood at the top of King David Street next to the Petra Hostel. One of them stood in the book depot, and one of them stood in the hospital, and just read the texts. Okay, this is your motivating factor, and this comes from the printing press, right? That's where the story starts. Now, Montefiore sends a guy by the name of Dr. Shimon Frankel. Not before Protestant mission. In the 1830s, The Jewish community of Europe did not send a doctor. They only did it because the Protestants had arrived. And so that's the impact. That's the influence. It's whatever this Protestant community did, other communities reacted accordingly. And that actually built up and established the modern medical mission, to the point where when the Protestants moved their hospital from Jerusalem to the Anglican school, right? That's the Anglican International School, became a hospital. This street, known as the Street of the Prophets, had 9 hospitals on it. You had the English hospital, the French hospital, the Russian hospital. You had 2 Jewish hospitals, one for the Sephardis and one for the Ashkenazis. You see, Shimon Frankel's problem is he was Ashkenazi. So guess who didn't go to see him? Sephardis. They went to the mission hospital still. Okay? You had 9 hospitals on this street. It was known as the Street of the Hospitals. Then we also established the House of Industry. So in 1843, we took people who, initially Jewish people, would receive chalutza, they would receive money from the rabbis as handouts. But if they inquired of the mission, if they actually became believers, those handouts would stop. So who was going to take care of them? You see, Protestant mission is often accused of, you bribed Jews, you gave them money. Well, we kind of had to give them money because you stopped giving them money, right? It's not that we gave them money first, because they didn't have any money because you stopped. So they established a thing called the House of Industry, where they taught Jewish people and Arabs, okay? They taught Arabs mother-of-pearl work. They taught Jewish people the craft of woodworking. And the institute that became known as Betzalel, the crafts community, all of their original founders were all trained in the House of Industry, all trained by the Protestant mission. And the famous man attached to the House of Industry is a Swiss-German by the name of Konrad Schick. He originally came with the Bruder House. When that didn't work out and he was going to leave, the London Jew Society asked him to head up the mission. And this created a pool of skilled carpenters and woodworkers in the city. They produced a lot of material, like a lot of material that you would sell to Christian pilgrims. So all that problems that you see down in the Shuk, really sorry, guys. Okay. Again, largely due to the Protestant missionary activity. But the best thing, I think, that the Protestants did when they came here and brought printing is mass education. It was the establishment of schools, not just for boys. They established a girls' school known as the Jewess Institution in 1849 by a lady by the name of Caroline Cooper. The Protestant mission always focuses heavily on education because you want people to read the Bible. In the 1800s, what's the value of a woman? Not very much, right? How many wives are we allowed to have, guys, in the Middle East? 4. How many wives are we allowed to have according to Jewish tradition? 1. The Bible doesn't say. So it is a rabbinic tradition that we are allowed to have the number of wives that King David had. Yeah. Not Solomon. King David. How many wives did King David have? 18. All right? And the interesting thing about him is, which wife produces the Messiah?
Bathsheba, the one he sent with.
Number 18. Right? You see, if you asked me, Aaron, you're a good little upright man, who would you want to have the king and the Messiah from? Well, I would take wife number 1. She's actually a princess. She's the daughter of King Saul. You know, this is a perfect candidate for King Messiah. What God does, and this tells us and teaches us something about God, is he takes the wife that everyone is like of filth, right? And this is adultery, this is murder, this is lies. And God says, okay, what's dark? I can make better. And he takes darkness and he makes light. And so it's out of number 18. Now, do Jews have 18 wives? No, right? The whole point is both in the Islamic world and in the rabbinic world, women were not valued as much, certainly weren't educated. Okay, heaven forbid we ever have an educated woman around here. And so they didn't have any schools. But along comes the Europeans, especially in the Protestant mission, okay, and they say, listen, we value our women over there, and women can go to schools. And so they began the education of women. Typical British, we recorded every single thing that we did. So in our hospitals, at the end of every day, we would say we used 3 feet of yarn, 16 band-aids, you know, 3 drops of iodine. Okay? But in the school, they also recorded every single baptism. And 25% of all the girls that went to that school were baptized. Oh. Right. So if you want to protect your daughters from going to the nasty mission, what do you have to do? Exactly. And that's the impact. Right, you bring in female education. Yes, there are other Christian communities here, and they've been here for 1,800 years. But it is the Protestant mission, motivated by the way it reads the Bible, with an extreme desire to make sure that everybody can read these sacred texts and come to knowing Jesus. And they have an incredible effect on the community, because now women are educated. Was that the actual intention? Let's go to the Middle East and teach girls how to read English. No. But that's the result. The result is mass female education. And that is one of, I think, one of the more positive things that the society has ever done. All right, so heading towards the end here. After the death of Alexander, Bishop Samuel Gobat arrives, and he is a member of CMS, although now he's a member of CMJ, but he invites CMS, Church Missionary Society, to actually come and enter the Middle East when they couldn't before, but now there is a Protestant base. So the Protestants arrive. They arrive into Egypt, they arrive into Lebanon, they begin to spread through to Iraq and into Persia. In the tradition of, there are no Pentecostals, there are no Charismatics, and so missionaries tended to be ordained, and they tended to be deacons and priests. And so in 1843, Michael Solomon Alexander ordained another Jewish guy by the name of Henry Aaron Stern, which he sent to Ethiopia. And the Ethiopian mission began. And the CMJ stayed in Ethiopia until 1981. Right? And so a lot of the people who are known as the Falash Mura, where did they hear the gospel from? Henry Aaron Stern. Because the agreement back then, in the 1840s and 1850s, was with the King of Abyssinia, that the Protestant mission was allowed to establish itself in Abyssinia, provided that all converts joined the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. Okay? But they also, in 1864, sent missionaries to Baghdad. They ordained them at Christchurch, sent them to Baghdad, and they established a church which was, until recently, headed up by Canon Andrew White, who is now the patron of the London Mission Society. So it's interesting how we go full circle. So the Protestants are now here, and they are now here in force. So in summary, Protestant mission motivated by the Bible, particularly a literal reading of the Bible, being non-state funded, critical of colonialism, not an instrument of colonialism per se, had reactionary movements to the mission, coupled with the introduction of education, political and social improvements, gave the potential for democracies, although not in the Middle East, and set up basically what we see involved in the Middle East today. Buildings, infrastructure, politics, medical, modern medicine, and the improvement of to women. So, missionaries are not a dirty word. They are a very positive thing to the society. Do I think that those improvements would have happened without Protestant missionaries? Probably. Would they have happened as fast? Definitely not. Would they look like they do today? No. They would take some other form. So the Protestant mission came here fueled by the Bible, and it was a reaction to whatever these guys were doing. We had to protect our communities, of which there's quite a number. Many of those communities had access to state funding, and nothing had been done by those states to assist those communities. But it was the reaction to Protestant missionary work which produced a lot of the positive benefits for this society. So, thanks to those Protestant missionaries for doing a great job.